Hi, I'm Jason Bryan from the Short Time Wrestling Podcast and founder of the Mat Talk Podcast Network. Shows on the network are individually owned and operated, and those opinions presented and expressed may not reflect others, the sponsors, patrons, or the parent network. Find more shows about the greatest sport in the world at the Mat Talk Podcast Network at mattalkonline.com.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of Flow Wrestling, along with a man who has some famous friends you've probably never heard of, Andy Hamilton, also of Flow Wrestling. This show is sponsored by Cliff Keen Athletic. Of course, this show is On the Mat, and we are, five days after the multi-divisional national duels, which is my favorite event of the year, and I am still buzzing. Different feel from when we went in 2020, but the result is the same. I love this event that takes place in Louisville, Kentucky.
Why is it a different feel from 2020, Kyle?
Well, venue is different, number one. Yep. Going into it, there was a little letdown for me since I like Division III wrestling so much, to not have Loras, not have Warburg, not have Augsburg. There was a few others, but I was looking forward to that piece. I like seeing that. So going into that, I like full lineups. And so what was it? A quarter of the teams had backed out through all of the divisions. I don't know what the numbers were, but it felt like numerous teams had backed out. So that, going into it, the first day, I didn't have quite the buzz as I did two years ago. Had a little bit more time to go to the venue the day before. I flew in that night and we ate. But I'll tell you what, that final day with the women's wrestling competition, I thought they stole the show, NAIA division and NCAA division. Ashley Sword, the first woman to coach a national duels championship, actually the first woman to reach the finals, and then she made history, first woman to coach a national duels championship. Congratulations to Ashley Sword of Life University. That was one heck of a duel there.
It was. You say the women stole the show, and they were tremendous. Like, those duels were awesome. But I would say that D2 was pretty crazy.
It was.
When you have St. Cloud State and Nebraska Kearney, it was one of the best dual meets I've seen in a long, long time. So many matches in there, hotly contested. St. Cloud State wins that duel to break the NCAA record for the longest winning streak. And then one round later, Central Oklahoma ends that streak at 77.
Sure did.
And the men's NAI division was tremendous, with Grandview and Life, such a burgeoning rivalry that we have there. And I think that's pretty cool what's going on there. And then, as you mentioned, D3 was a little disappointing not to have the entire field there, but I thought the UW Lacrosse North Central duel was really entertaining. And so just an awesome event all the way around.
For those who don't know about Omi Acosta at Life University, how would you describe him?
Omi is a live wire, I would say. On the corner, he is energetic. You can't stop watching him.
Yeah.
You can't. I mean, Omi's tank runs full. And I think it'd be a lot of fun to have that guy in my corner.
Sure would. Boy, and you took a lot of pictures, and I noticed the camera's always clicking whenever he's over there, because you got one shot where it looked like he got knocked down in a prize fight, but no, he was down there trying to tell someone how to get out from underneath, from my recollection.
Yeah, that's what's happening. One of his guys is getting ridden a little bit, and I think kind of a crab ride situation, and Omi is trying to demonstrate in match of how to get away.
My only criticism of the event is that it's too good, and I don't know how to follow it yet. So the way I had to follow it was in the semifinals. I just was all in on the men's side because of the history you're talking about. Grandview had the streak going, and I don't want to say it was on the rocks, but Reinhardt gave him a little tussle in the first half of the duel, and then Grandview pulled away. But then the St. Cloud State making the history, I just wanted to be there for all of that, but then I had to just kind of transition over to the women's side, and I'm glad I did, because just King beating McKendry, Life beating Campbellsville. I just thought that was a really important piece of history there. So I kind of just had to go back and forth. So semis for me was the men's, and then finals was the women's. But if you have suggestions, I don't know how to follow it.
It's so hard. You're spot on. It's an awesome event, and it's, you know, it's like, I love ice cream, but I don't eat it a gallon at a time, right? Like, yeah. It feels like you're eating a gallon of ice cream at a time with how much there is to consume at once. And that's the downside of it. There's, you know, everything is happening all at once. The semis are going on all at once. The finals of every division are taking place at the same time, and you can't possibly watch everything there is. And, you know, the hard part is like, there's not a big jumbotron to have names of who's actually on the mat at the same time. I think there are probably some things that they could do to make it a better, more viewer friendly event, I think. And I think there's some things that they've tried in the past too, but, if you're there to lock in on one team and one team only, it's tremendous. You get to see 4 or 5 dual meets in the span of 2 days and get to follow everything else that's going on too. But, you know, to try to lock in on everything that's going on across every division, it's impossible.
Let's transition to Division One and what's happening there. The big news, of course, Spencer Lee is out for the season. I think he just had surgery. Maybe he posted
Friday.
Something. Yeah, okay. So he's had surgery since then. But I think there's just a renewed excitement with Drake Ayala coming into the lineup as a true freshman. This is pretty exciting.
Yeah. And Drake is a guy that we've had a chance to follow here in Iowa for the past 4 years, and guy that we've had a chance to interact with quite a bit during his high school career. I think we both think really highly of him, not just as a wrestler. He's a tremendous guy to watch, wrestles super high pace, always on the attack, but so, you know, from a character and personality standpoint, just a lot of fun to be around, and we've enjoyed our interactions with him.
And when you think about it's kind of crazy to think that you have a couple guys from Fort Dodge and the lineup at 125 pounds, Brody Teske for Northern Iowa, and now Drake Ayala at the University of Iowa. Don't know that I'll have an opportunity to meet unless it's at the NCAA championships, but Fort Dodge doing some good things on the high school scene right now.
Yeah, and that's been the case for, well, since Brody Teske got into high school with his group of guys that he's come up with, the Lara brothers and, you know, Drew Bennett as well. And so many, you know, now you got Drake Ayala, Drew Ayala. You know, it's a rich wrestling community there. And I think what's really neat is this bunch, take it back a generation ago, and their dads were highly successful wrestlers at Fort Dodge and won quite a bit. And so, pretty cool to see the connection with wrestling in that community.
I want to go back to Spencer Lee. You said something last year about Spencer Lee, is I think you said he's the most dominant first period wrestler in the history of our sport, which I agree with. What's interesting to me is I don't think we would have ever even said that until Spencer Lee. I think he's the first person that made us aware of first period domination in that kind of a way. I don't think that was ever even a thought to think of first period domination until Spencer Lee. Do you?
No, I mean, and I say that like kind of being a prisoner of the moment, but I can't think of any, you know, when I said that, but I can't think of anyone else that's even remotely close to like the output that he, you know, I mean, how many first period techs have we seen over the course of the last 4 seasons with him?
Yeah. And that's what you think about is that domination where your head's on a swivel. And there were so many times where he would be out there and the match would be over, and if you weren't in your seat ready to watch at Carver Hawkeye Arena or wherever he was, that match was going to be over really fast. So I thought about that a couple weeks ago. Like, yeah, I'd never even thought about first period domination. I guess I thought about domination with a Ben Askren, and sometimes he would get first period falls, but I don't know that I thought of it in that way to ever compartmentalize it and say, yeah, this guy's a, a dominant first period wrestler. He's the first that comes to mind for me.
Well, go back to Spencer's debut in Carver Hawkeye Arena, first match after they pulled the red shirt. It was a 45 second fall against Ravon Foley.
Yeah.
And so that's just kind of set the tone for his career. And, you know, one of the, as great as he's been, I think one of the things that, I don't know the right way to say this, it feels like we've been maybe shortchanged a little bit, is that like Spencer's been so great that he's been off the mat so fast that we haven't had a chance to see him wrestle. And then you factor in the injuries, of course, too. But certainly hopeful that everything goes smooth with the recovery and that he's back and at full strength. And we get to see him wrestle a full season next year and really have a chance to appreciate how great the guy is. And, you know, I think there are a lot of positions where he's exceptionally skilled that we haven't been able to see maybe as much as I would like, just because it's been wash, rinse, repeat, takedown, turn, off the mat.
It is, dude. It's and he just gets in that short offense so well. And then, I mean, I'm wondering as we talk about this, if he decided not to pin someone, what's his ceiling for a 7-minute match of points if there weren't a technical fall? I mean, could he get upwards of 75, 100? I mean, if you're teching a guy within the first couple minutes and it's probably, what, 17 to 18 points, 15 to 17, somewhere in there. He's just rolling at that point. I mean.
Like if he went Satya of World Championships, yeah. Or just if the tech exactly. was optional, he just kept going, right?
Yeah, I'd love to see that, especially with 4-point near falls and just see what he could rack up. I think it would be a lot of fun. Not for the opponent, of course, but we're going to miss him, man. I just, he's been such a staple of college wrestling and the narrative and Tom Branson in the press conference, he's a living legend. He's already gained that stature of being a living legend and people in Iowa City love him. And I think there's times he has to put his hood up if he goes to Hy-Vee or a grocery store because he's going to get recognized.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think about Iowa and the, you know, the program as a whole, and he's put it back on top. I mean,
yeah.
Granted, they're, you know, the Hawkeyes have done a tremendous job recruiting around Spencer Lee too, but I think that's a big factor. And, you know, things were pointing in the right direction when they got Caleb Young and Kemmerer and Marinelli, and then you add Spencer and then all of the pieces of the puzzle that have fit into place since DeSanto, Ironman, Warner, Cassiope, et cetera, Max Murin. But I think he's kind of the linchpin of the whole thing. And now what will be interesting is without him in the lineup, you got some guys that have kind of been, you know, he's the main attraction and gives guys a chance to be in the spotlight a little bit more. And how do they handle that? Do they, you know, does it give them a chance to flourish a little bit more? You know, do we take a greater appreciation for some of these other guys that have had exceptional careers, but haven't quite gotten to the top yet? And then I also, you know, from an Iowa standpoint, just really eager to see how Drake, the rest of his freshman year, plays out, because I think knowing what I know about him, he's a quick learner. That has been consistent with what I've heard about him for 4 years, and especially in his first several months in the Iowa program, that the coaches have said how quick he is at picking up things and how coachable he is. And so just really eager to see his growth match to match and where he winds up in mid-March.
Yeah, fun storyline to follow. And again, you can't overstate some of these things. Iowa almost sells out of season tickets.
Well, they did.
did they sell it out? They sold. So last I heard, it was like closing in on 15,000. What's the capacity? 15s plus, something like that?
I don't think it's quite that anymore. I think when they went through some renovations. I think it used to be 15.5. I don't think it's quite that anymore.
It isn't. Okay. So they sold out.
On season tickets. They leave some for visiting team and things of that nature. So there may be some single tickets you can pick up from time to time, but season tickets are sold out.
That's astounding.
It is. They're outdrawing the basketball program by a fairly significant margin right now.
We need to just stop on how huge that is, because brands kind of tried to downplay it. Like, is it really that big of a deal? Yeah, it's that big of a deal. Selling out a season tickets in an arena that big to show that kind of support for a program, that's unprecedented, especially since you look back at Gable's final season in 97, which were on the 25-year anniversary of that, where they set the all-time record. They averaged less than 4,000. They averaged less than 4,000 in Gable's final stint. And now they're averaging a sellout?
Kyle, the year before Tom arrived, they had a dual meet against Illinois. Year before Tom became a head coach, they had a dual meet against Illinois that there were 2,200 people in the stands.
Man.
For Illinois, a very good Illinois team.
2,200, and now we're averaging a sellout. That's unbelievable. So kudos to Iowa and the Hawkeye Wrestling program for getting it to that point. That's unbelievable.
All right. So if you look the top attendances of all time, we got 27 crowds in NCAA history in excess of 14,000. And Iowa is going to get that for every dual meet this season.
Woo!
Now, there may not be 14,000 people in the stands for some of the early season duels that they've had for every dual meet. There might not be 14,000 people in the stands for every dual meet, but that's going to be the announced attendance because they've sold that many tickets.
Yeah. That's unreal, man. Unreal. Kudos to them. And then we have to point out the 42,287 that they had on November 14th, 2015. That was Grapple on the Gridiron, which was a massive event. I wish they would have been a little bit more lenient on counting the people they let in. I think it was more like 50,000.
So I got the portrait of it hanging up here in this studio. And Tom Brandt said that Luke Eustace went in with a magnifying glass and counted the heads of everybody in the entire stadium and had upwards of 52,000 counted.
Gosh, that bothers me. Just you saying that you're leaving 10K on the table of a record. That's because you can tell, even looking at that picture, that it's more than 42,000, because it's almost going to the end zone of a 70,000-plus field.
Yeah, I think...
You can tell.
You have the... I think there were some people sitting in the north end zone. The south end zone is completely jam-packed. And then the east and west grandstands are probably... What would you say? I mean, they were probably upwards of 50, 60% at least, right? I mean, I thought they were, like, without looking, I think they were close to 2/3.
Yeah. Incredible picture. Man, wish it was the right count, but for the time being, it's 42,287. We got to talk about two more teams, Penn State, Michigan. I have never seen anything like this. Brady Berge's back at Penn State after being a volunteer assistant coach at South Dakota State University. I'm still having a hard time wrapping my head around this.
It's crazy.
It is. There's so many things I would like to talk to Brady Berge about. Not that he goes back, but just the thinking and why you wouldn't just stay there at South Dakota State. Why go back to Penn State? How that works with getting back into school. Just a lot of things there. It's a crazy storyline, but Penn State just kind of keeps adding layers to their lineup. Of course, they have Drew Hildebrandt in at 125 for his final semester of college, so that really bolsters their lineup with having a returning fourth-place finisher for Penn State. Nittany Lions look good right now.
It's the Berge thing's not unprecedented for college athletics. Zeb Nolan started for Iowa State at quarterback, and then transferred out and wound up as a graduate assistant this year at South Carolina.
Hmm.
And then ended up starting the first game at quarterback. I don't know how many games he wound up playing, but he ended up playing for him at quarterback after being a GA earlier in the year.
But every time you think you've seen all the storylines that can play out, then Brady Berge goes back to Penn State after being a volunteer assistant. Really,
it's wild.
It is. It really is. And our own Shane Sparks feels good about him in the lineup. I think he thinks he's going to score 15 points at Nationals.
If he's healthy, that's what Shane said.
Yep, so we're going to follow that. So we're going to have the Brady Berge tracker. Of course, we can only do that after the national tournament. But believe me, we will be counting his points and seeing if Shane is right if he scores 15 points for the Nittany Lions. So we'll see there. And we're getting a taste of Michigan right now. The Flow Wrestling dual meet didn't go as they wanted with some COVID protocols, but there were four matches that took place at that against Arizona State. We've seen Nick Suriano back in the lineup, and he's down at 125. They have a good team. There's no doubt about it. Top to bottom, this is the Wolverines are going to be in contention. I think Penn State's a little stronger right now, but Wolverines are going to be right there.
Next 2 weeks, Kyle. You got Penn State, Michigan.
Which you're going to.
Yeah. Yep. And then you got Penn State at Iowa.
A lot's going to be on the line here in those dual meets. I hope they're full and that there's nothing that derails us from having full lineups in both of those. But
a lot's on the line and yet nothing is on the line.
I know. Exactly. More just the entertainment value. But I just want to see these Penn State guys as often as possible. RBY, Brooks, on down the Starachi, Lee. You just have four national champions in the lineup and you want to see the best guys compete. So
let's tie it back into the beginning. We were so enthralled with the dual meets down in Louisville with titles on the line. Like, how is it that Division One is not have something like this?
I know. It's so good. It's so good. And we could moan and complain about having it back at the Dome, which is just in your backyard. We can walk there from where our studio is. But until they feel that dual meets matter, we're going to still be talking about the multi-divisional as one of our favorite events.
Yes, we will. Even though we didn't get you to the Blue Horse, we didn't get you a mint julep, we didn't get you any derby pie.
I know, but it was still a blast, and can't wait to go back next year. I can't wait for our guest. Eric Juergens, two-time NCAA champion for the University of Iowa, is going to be on this program. I know you worked with him when you were at the Iowa City Press Citizen and probably interviewed him numerous times. We're going to have him on the show. Let's hear from Cliff Keene, then we'll be back with Eric Juergens next.
This winter, get into the folk style and club wrestling seasons with some fresh new gear from Cliff Keene. Everything you need to hit the mats, from headgear to singlets and warm-ups, knee pads, and workout gear. Cliff Keene is the dependable brand to see you through. And don't forget, on-the-mat subscribers can save big at CliffKeene.com. Go to CliffKeene.com and use coupon code ONTHEMAT at checkout and take 20% off your order. Yep, that's coupon code ONTHEMAT gets you 20% off. Just go to www.CliffKeene.com and click Shop Wrestling.
Our guest today is Eric Juergens. He was a four-time undefeated state wrestling champion in Iowa for Maquoketa High School. Went on to the University of Iowa, where he was a four-time All-American, two-time NCAA champion, third twice, first twice. That means he was 6-0 on the biggest day of the NCAA championships, which is Saturday. Eric Juergens, how are you?
Pretty good, man. How are you guys doing?
We're doing really well. And that was just your wrestling credentials. You have other stuff going on. You have Young Guns. You are selling guns. Let's start with the selling guns. What are you doing there? What's your profession?
So I work for a firearm importer out of Reno, Nevada called G-Force Arms. And I actually work for another importer that's based out of Reno, Nevada, Legacy Sports International. And I stepped away from there last year, and it was just one of those where there's some stuff at Legacy that maybe I wasn't just completely happy with. I don't have a lot of bad things to say about him, though. I'm, for the most part, got treated right and got approached by my old boss about coming on, and made the jump. And so, yeah, I sell, you know, we import firearms, and I sell them to, you know, farm chains, distributors, you know, the wholesalers, and you know, generally to the people who will sell to the final public.
Is there a typical day in that profession? It sounds like it might be pretty diverse on what day to day looks like.
Yeah. It's very different. When I was working for Legacy Sports, I handled a lot more accounts than I do now. I was more of just a regional territory guy. And so I covered, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri. And, you know, a normal week might have me traveling, you know, 5-6 hours somewhere, and then drive around, you know, store to store, and just try to get our catalogs out there, get our literature out there, try to sell guns, obviously the store. Whereas now I'm working, you know, with much larger accounts, and you know, a lot of my work is done from home. And if I do make a trip, like I went down not too long ago to Orscheln's in Moberly, Missouri, and then I swung over to Union, Missouri, and met with John at Dickey Bug. I went last week or 2 weeks ago up to Minnesota and met with Jamie at Sportsman's Guide. So, you know, just it's much more selective travel, I guess, in a good way. You know, I'm dealing with a lot less people, and which allows me to build the relationship a lot better and give a lot better customer service, obviously, too.
During the quarantine in 2020, guns and ammo were just flying off the shelves. It was kind of a new currency. It was like gold almost. How did that affect your business? Or is there a demand that's so high that you don't have the ability to keep up right now?
Yeah, I mean, home defense for a while there, I mean, it was uncharted waters. Like, no one in the industry, no matter how long they've been around, had seen anything to that scale. So, I mean, it was pretty wild. Set some pretty crazy numbers out there. it was a fun ride. Like, it was really exciting to be in sales, just because, like, it wasn't work. Like, it's not work when people are calling you and begging you for guns. And when I'm talking about selling guns, I'm talking about, like, selling containers at a time, you know, 1,050 guns at one phone call. You know, that's fun. You know, the ammo hasn't really caught up yet. It's getting better. You know, you're starting to see some of that stuff out there, but hunting rounds are still hard to come by. Ammo in general is still hard to come by. Whereas the home defense shotgun, that market has slowed down significantly. You know, there's all sorts of things that we could talk about why it was so bad. Obviously, the media played a huge part in that. In my opinion, I guess, of dividing the country. It's easy when you're in that arena to kind of see where things are getting, you know, strings are getting pulled. But, you know, the rioting and everything, there's a lot of people that were scared. Like, a lot of people that you would never guess would get uncomfortable and scared about the life in America. And because of that, there was just this huge surge.
Why do you think that was, though, with guns and ammo, that during the lockdown that it went through the roof? Is it people were scared of what was to come and they needed to defend themselves because something might happen? I don't understand that. Can you maybe take us through what that looks like?
I think you had several factors playing in. You already had some shortages. Like, we'd already seen some shortages. Like, I mean, everybody saw this, even though I don't know why it became a thing, like toilet paper. Right. That was one of the first things that there were shortages on. You know, people talk about the supply chain and the economy. There is trillions of little details and little relationships and little nuances that go on to do the supply chain. Right. A lot of people sit there and they think of the supply chain as being, you know, like the port being blocked or being held up or whatever. I mean, it goes so far past that. It's unrealistic to think that just, you know, getting the ports to open up longer would take care of the problem. You know, when you're shutting down all these little factories, even to begin to start to get a part, right? you have to get the materials together to make that little part, to start a bigger part, to start maybe a final assembly of something. And so you had all these supply chains getting disrupted and people starting to run out of, you know, meat went through the roof and then it became hard to get, and food in general, it started to get, I wouldn't say it was, I don't know if it ever became a huge problem, you know what I mean? But it definitely became something on somebody's radar when you go to the supermarket and there's, you know, maybe there's no hamburger there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you might be able to get chicken or you might be able to get pork, but there's no hamburger. Or maybe all the meat's gone. And yeah, you can get your soup or whatnot. But I mean, I'm sure you guys remember that, where you go into any kind of supermarket that didn't have to shut down, obviously. And, you know, their shelves would just be ransacked, you know? And so you had that fear maybe about people not being able to eat, not being able to get food for their families or whatnot. And then all of a sudden there's the divisiveness. You're seeing on the media left and right, all these rioting, going on, and all this, you know, just fighting and obviously trying to create racial tension there and such. The media doesn't make money unless they stroke the fire, right? Like, feel good stories do not sell. And so they're doing everything they can to obviously, highlight what they think is important, which for them is, you know, usually the bad things about the country, not any of the good stuff. And so between all those, I think you started to see just an overall uneasiness, you know, to the point where it wasn't just that conspiracy theory, you know, far out there right wing guy who's just, you know, maybe a little nuts to boot. You're starting to see it in the mainstream population. And once those people started buying guns and there was, you know, shortages to begin with, now all of a sudden, you know, people are like, well, I can't even buy something to protect myself. And what if there's no food? And what if we go into this, you know, apocalyptic scenario? So it was definitely an interesting time, I'll tell you that.
Let's transition over to Young Guns Wrestling Club, which was founded by you and Jody Stripmatter. Of course, Jody is in Pennsylvania. You're in the Quad Cities right now. Would you take us back to the formative years of that and why you guys decided to create this? Because we went through your credentials and you're one of the all-time greats in Iowa wrestling history. Why did you feel like this was the path for you? If you could walk us through the formation of Young Guns and why you've continued to be part of this.
Yeah, I don't know, even know if it ever was a path I chose or more or less just kind of found myself on. You know, it got back in the day, obviously Gable was still running the Hawk Club there. And I remember, you know, I stayed around to watch my brother. You know, I wanted to stay around no matter what, just see how my brother would do and stuff like that and help support him. And got through that and he graduated. And, you know, I was training and I was one of those guys who kind of accomplished what I wanted to, you know, very, very lucky in that aspect. And so I don't know if I really had stuff personally that I wanted to, you know, climb. You know what I mean? You got to have that burn to want to stay there. And I was training and whatnot. And then, you know, weight was kind of always an issue. And then you add in the fact that they start telling us, you know, they might not be able to pay us. And that kind of put a sour mood on it. And then 1 month it became true. It was like, hey, we're not going to be able to even pay you. So, you know, it's hard to train, at that level and have any kind of job. You hope at the minimum that at least they can help you if you're going to try and, you know, achieve that level to have some financial support, so you can train the way you want to. And like, for me, that was kind of like the last straw. I just, you know what I mean? I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to try something different. And I had a gentleman approach me about trying to run a youth club, and the idea on paper sounded pretty good. And I remember how Jody was struggling. And I actually encouraged Jody. I was like, you know, you should just move up the weight and, you know, go beat some guys up. Like, you know, between everything going on, my heart is just not in this, but like to do it this way. And, you know, that, I don't know if that sat really well with him either. And as we were talking about it, obviously we're fantastic friends, you know, we're still great friends, still best friends. And, it was one of those things where it's like, you know, if this isn't the route you want to take, like, I think this theory, this idea of the club, could go well enough to support, you know, two people, you know, and just see where it goes. And I think with him, it was the same thing. You're not going to get paid. He was cutting massive amounts of weight. Like, if I was cutting weight, like, it's night and day difference to what kind of weight he was cutting. And it just became one of those things that I think he wanted to try something different, and so did I. And so we were like, heck with it. Let's try it. You know, we had done wrestling camps together a whole bunch, and like, it was just something that I thought that was kind of a natural, easy thing for both of us. Like, all right, we'll try this adventure, see how it goes. And we learned a lot of things in Michigan. You know, we learned that we could make the club work, which was obviously a great thing. You know, and we saw how we could build numbers, learned a little bit about the advertising side of it, the financial side of it, but learned Michigan wasn't for us, you know, and I wanted to go back to Iowa, and I just could not get a facility. And, Jody at the time actually had kind of a job interview, and he was going back to try and get a job, and you'd have to ask him. I can't remember what the job was, but he had a job interview, and he was like, yeah, I'm out of here. I'm done once the season's over, you know. And so he was heading back to Pennsylvania regardless. And I just kept trying to get into Iowa. I couldn't get a facility anywhere where I wanted to live. You know, I had a good relationship with the Loras College coach at the time, Randy Stewart. And I was pushing real hard to get in there. And he's like, hey, I'm trying, but it's not something you can do real easily right off the bat. And obviously with no real commitment, I guess, it was kind of one of those things where Jody goes, hey, you can run this club in PA. We had a little 2-day tournament or 2-day camp we had always done there like the last 6 years. We would get like 100 kids. You know, you know, for people, the internet is common day nowadays, right? Everybody understands, like, the world has become smaller. But even back then, you know, until I went to Pennsylvania, I really didn't understand the numbers game. I really didn't understand it. You know, you look at the numbers game, Pennsylvania has what, almost 13 million people, and Iowa has 3 million, you know, and if you take a certain percentage of the top athletes, you obviously are going to get a lot more of that top level athlete when you have the bigger numbers, you know, just by simple math alone. If it's almost whatever, you know, 4 or 5 times the amount of kids or whatever, then you're going to have 4 or 5 times the amount of top level kids. And so I guess that was kind of how it went, is went back there knowing that I could start a club there. Jody's job interview fell through, and it became one of those things, well, heck with it. We'll just do the club together like we always planned. And club got going pretty good, and I eventually found a site back home in Iowa and made it work and made the move.
Club wrestling is such a fixture in the sport now. It's so prevalent. But going back 20 years when this all began for Young Guns, what did the landscape look like then?
You know, it's so weird. People take it for granted. The people that were kind of coming of age through this transition period. I remember my first cell phone. I didn't get my first cell phone until I graduated college. You know, I can still remember using payphones in college. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Like the landscape, it's so crazy to think about it, because you hate to think you're that old. But the fact of the matter is, we are, you know, and so when you talk about the landscape, it's not just different on the wrestling side. Like, the world in general was different, you know. Internet that people did have was usually landline. It was unbelievably slow. I obviously was not a big internet guy. Yeah, it was just a crazy different world. The club scene, as far as wrestling goes, like that, you know, when you ask what was that landscape like, again, internet wasn't real big, so it's not like the world was small. My general knowledge of it, like, I didn't really know of any other clubs like that. You know, now going back, I think Bormat or whatever would have had, I think his club might have been around that time in the Chicago area. I really couldn't even tell you. You know, it's just something I've never really looked back. I know at the time there was nothing really like it, and the idea intrigued me. I was like, you think people would actually pay, you know, money for us to try and coach them? But nowadays it's very obvious. Like, what kind of training do you want for your kids? You know, do you want the general mill? And it's not a put down on some of these programs. Like, it's not at all. I think it's outstanding how some some people step up and their love of the sport is so great that they volunteer all sorts of time or basically volunteer because the monetary stipend is so low, right? That's a lot of time that they generously give to the sport. But it was intriguing to me that people would be willing to pay to get a lot more out of what they're getting for their athlete, you know, for their son or daughter, to learn. And so, you know, just kind of dabbled in the waters. And, the difference between me and Jody is Jody decided to branch out and make it full time. Whereas me, I've always been that guy, diversify. We get into all sorts of the darts I throw and try and get revenue streams going. But I wanted a normal job too. You know, I was looking ahead already. I knew I wanted to have kids someday. And so I wanted a normal job so that way I wasn't doing club, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week. And that's what I used to do for probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. You know, Monday through Thursday in the evenings when people were getting off work, I was going to work. You know, and there's a sacrifice there, you know, that people don't see.
Let's break down your college career and how this transpired. So as we mentioned, you're a 4-time state champion, undefeated for Maquoketa High School. Dan Gable is still the head wrestling coach at the University of Iowa. So he recruits you. You redshirt during the 1996-1997 season, which happens to be Dan Gable's last season as head coach. And then Jim Zaleski takes over. Let's just start with that. The recruiting pitch by Gable, and was it a foregone conclusion that you were going to go to the University of Iowa because Gable was the kingpin at the time?
You know, people seem to forget that he did kind of like that partial step down. Like, he's like, I think I'm going to step down. I'm not really going to step down. Like, for a while there, Jimmy was, he was the interim head coach or whatever they called it, you know? It was definitely different. Like, it never even occurred to me that Gable was going to not be my coach when I went there. And I don't have any complaints about that. You know, I think when I look back, I don't really think of it as regrets. Like, there's just things that maybe if they would have went a little different, then okay. But, by and large, I'm quite happy with the way my college played out, I guess, as the coaches go. You know, I'm not really sure what you're looking for there with the question, but,
the question was why Iowa? I mean, Gable was still the coach. So why did you decide to attend the University of Iowa?
You know, as I've mentioned before, so I come from a town, I think, I don't know what Maquoketa's population is, but I know it used to be around 5,500, 6,000 people, very small town, very rural, blue collar workers. And I was pretty much that naive, you know, redneck, you know, live in the woods, shoot guns, work hard, you know, and it's almost embarrassing to look back on it, but the truth is the truth, right? And I remember telling my mom's like, you're going to go to college. And I said, I don't know. Like, cause even back then the numbers were stupid, right? The numbers were crazy high. And I was like, how am I ever going to pay for that? You know, I just didn't see it. And wrestling, luckily for me, I started having people reach out, and I was smart enough to realize, like, hey, if I can get the free education and I'm not having to foot this bill, I don't have anything to lose. And it was one of those where if I was going to do that, I was such a homebody that it was going to be somewhere close, right? And then obviously I was so lucky in the aspect that Iowa is what Iowa was at the time, right? Like, just a powerhouse wrestling, Gable being one of the greatest coaches there is for college wrestling, and having that in my backyard, you know, there's just a lot of things that kind of came together for me wanting to be close. And I mean, I originally verbaled you and I, you know, and then just had a different kind of mindset. That's a story in itself there, why I didn't go to UNI, but my sister was at UNI, you know? And so,
well, you got to tell us a story. We got to interject. You just can't say that's a story in itself. You got to tell us why you didn't go to UNI.
I get long-winded, and I don't know if you guys ever want to hear the rest of the story or not.
Well, we do, so go for it.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my sister was at the University of Northern Iowa, and Don Briggs was the coach, and I had a real good relationship with some of the wrestlers there, because obviously with my sister going there, I went up there a few times, and Tom Briggs is a great guy. Very personable. Joel Greenlee was the assistant coach. He's an awesome guy. And so being around those guys, being around the team, and it was a little bit more rural, you know, when you think of that landscape, I guess. And so I thought it was kind of a good fit. And I went up there, and I kept telling Iowa I wasn't really that interested. And they would keep calling. And about halfway through my year, I basically verbaled you and I. I'm like, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm not signing anything yet or whatever, but like, I want to go there. Like my sister, like, I think it's a great fit. Like, I like you guys. And part of it was David Kilgard at the time, you know, we were both wrestling and we would see each other, and he was one of their big recruits, and he was going to go to UNI, and, you know, we would wrestle in tournaments and same tournaments, and he's a great guy. And I'm like, you know what? We help build this program back, maybe, et cetera. How cool would that be? And then I went there for a visit, you know, like the official visit. And they pulled me in the office, and, you know, it's kind of weird. Like, even looking back right now, it's weird, but at the same time, it's the truth is they sit me down and like, you know, here's our plan. You know, we're going to redshirt you. And then, you know, we really think, you know, after the senior graduates, you step in the lineup and we really think you can win, you know, a national title or two. And I just remember stopping. I was like, what? And he's like, well, we really think you win, you know, like a national title or maybe even two. And it was just so different from the coach that I had, which was, you know, Coach Tampere, Jeff Tampere at Maquoketa was always like, you know, why couldn't you win everything? You know, it doesn't matter where you fall, but where do you shoot for? You shoot for everything, right? You shoot for everything, and what you get is what you get. That's, but you always try, you try to get everything. And I just sat there. I'm like, why couldn't I try and win four? And he kind of stumbled a little bit. And he kind of mumbled and he's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, we want you to try and win four. We just think, you know, realistically, you know, and he's trying to recover. And I remember going home and just thinking, what? Like, who has that mindset? Like, who has that mindset that you don't even think you're going to win when you go out on the mat? Like, it just, and again, I was that weirdo that had just lucky enough to have enough success in high school to think that that's a real realistic goal for kids going into college, which we all know it isn't, right? Like, very few people are going to be a Spencer Lee or Cale Sanderson or a Kyle Day. They're just not very, you know, that statistical odd is so crazy low, but it doesn't change that everybody should shoot for that. In my mind, right? Like, why shouldn't every kid who goes into college that wants to wrestle aim to win every match he wrestles, right? That should be the goal. And so when I went back, Iowa had called me again that week. And when they called, I was like, you know what? I'll come up for that visit. You guys keep wanting me to visit. I'll come up for that visit. I just want to see what you guys, you know, have going on there and what you have to say. And so I went up for the visit, and obviously they sent me down in the room in the office, and we're talking, and, you know, they're like, here's the deal. We want you to come up here and we want you to, we want you to redshirt behind these really good guys. And then we want you to step in that lineup and we want you to go out and win a national title as a freshman. And I was like, okay. And I just went home, you know, after the visit. And I just, those two moments in each visit just kept playing through my mind. And that Sunday night, you know, I got back from Iowa City, and that Sunday night, Gable called, and he just kept pressing me. He's like, what do you want to do? Like, I'm telling him, I don't know. I really don't know. I need to think about it. And he's like, why? Where do you want to be? What's your goal? Where do you want to be? And I was like, you know what? I do know what I want to do. I want to go win. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to go there. I'm going to go to Iowa. He's like, really? I'm like, I'm there. I'm coming to Iowa. And I'm not kidding you. 10 minutes later, the phone rings. Like, this is a true story. 10 minutes later, 10 minutes. And my mom answers it. She's like, hey, it's for you. It's Don Briggs. And so I pick up the phone and he goes, tell me it's not true. Tell me it's not true. And I said, I'm sorry, man, but it is. It's true. Like, I appreciate all your time and effort. And I wish I would have had a chance to call you first. But the truth is, like, I don't know if our goals align. And he knew why I didn't go. He's like, I knew as soon as I said that stuff in the office that I shouldn't have said it, and it came out wrong. And he's like, and I didn't mean it that way. He goes, but I understand why you felt that. And I was like, well, I just appreciate everything. I wish you guys the best of luck. And, you know, David Kilgard ended up going to Oklahoma. And yeah, that's that why in the road for me.
Let's go back to the high school piece, though. 144-0, four state championships. How did you get so good? Because Maquoketa isn't the Northeast Iowa power that you have throughout the state, like a Lisbon or Waterloo West during the 1960s. How did you get so good in high school?
You ever read the book Outliers?
Sure. Malcolm Gladwell?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that kind of theory, you know, and not that... Does everybody who does great things have to have certain attributes? 100%, right? Like somebody does really well at something over a long extended period of time, like, or does great things. They're going to have a certain amount of attributes there's no hesitation there for sure. But I think there's so many things, right place, right time, right variables, that just kind of lend themselves to the moment. Right. Like I had two parents that we were not well off, but were more than willing to sacrifice their time, sacrifice finances to make sure that if we wanted to follow something and chase it, we could. You know, there was never a, oh, no, you can't go to that camp or no, we can't make the drive. I mean, my dad would drive us up to Lawrence College. He worked in Dubuque. Okay. And so where we lived on the far side of Maquoketa, it was about an hour drive every day for him to go to work. So on Monday, Wednesday, he would come back from work. You know, he goes to work at like 5 a.m, comes back, picks us up, drives back up, sits there while we have practice, and then drives us back to Maquoketa. You know, we had a group of dads that got the kids together. We didn't really have a club in Maquoketa. And so you want to talk about like the club scenario. We had nothing. We had, it was called Redbird Wrestling. It was 4 Mondays out of the year. That's it. 4 Mondays. So as you can imagine, just wasn't really producing anything as far as real good talent when you only practice four days out of the entire year. And so all these dads get together. There are 8 brothers in it. Me and my brother being, you know, 2 of them. And by the end of the year, we had 24 kids. And all it was is we went to the high school and we asked if we could use the room. And, you know, back then it was a different landscape. The janitor would let us in and obviously it was supervised. And we had a former high school place winner, Chuck Wilson, that would come in, and he was a dad of 2 of the kids in there, 2 of the brothers in there. And, you know, we would get to train twice a week. And then pretty soon I remember going to high school. Here's a funny story. I go to high school and I just happen to see, Keith Bullock showering and putting on clothes. And I'm like, what are you doing here? You know, it's like 7:30 in the morning. Why are you here so early? And I just happened to get to school early. I think it was just one of those things where I'm a little early and he's running a little late. He's like, well, I was practicing. And I was like, what? Like you can come in and practice. He's like, yeah, you know, I get the janitor to open the door. He's like, I can either run or lift weights or get somebody to come in and wrestle. And I immediately that night when I got back home, I told my parents I want to go in the morning, you know, and they did. They made sure I got up and they made sure to get me to school. And, you know, I had all those things going for me. And then you look at Jeff Tampier, who had built a stellar program before I got there. You know, we had our first state champion the year before I entered high school. You know, I was not our first state champion, but our very first state champion was only the year before. So I was coming up through a good period of being in the program. You know what I mean? Solid numbers, good workout partners, similar minded people with goals, you know, and, you know, if there's one thing Coach T was good at is do things the right way and be better prepared than everybody else. Like as far as shape, we were never out of shape. And it's not like anybody works any harder than anybody else, right? Like you don't outwork somebody one practice to one practice. Like if you were to ask somebody how hard do they go, they're going to tell you hard as they can. And if you're going to ask me, I'm going to tell you as hard as I can. But like, as far as outworking people by doing extra things, like he always made sure the room was open in the mornings. If we wanted to come in and lift, he'd open up the room, make sure you could lift weights. He was there if you needed to drill. And I do mean him. He would drill with you if you needed to drill. I mean, that kind of level of commitment from high school coach is just, you know, you don't see that. You just don't see it. And I think a lot of those factors contributed to my overall success, without a doubt.
You know, you flip it forward a few months after you you sign with Iowa. Your first semester, you get into that room, and you go from being an undefeated four-timer to wrestling Tom and Terry Brandt, Ironside, McGinnis, Mena, Whitmer, go on down the line. All these guys. What are the early months like for you in that room?
You know, I've told this to so many people. The first 3 months were like the dark months. They were like depressive months, you know, three months of just hell trying to bridge that gap from, you know, you just go from practices where you go in there, even in a hard practice, you know, you're going to be the one winning, you know, you're going to be the one beating up on guys, you know, you're going to, you know, even if you're getting pushed, because, you know, I would wrestle our 174 pounder in practice all the time when I was in high school. Like, you move up to find people to challenge you, right? And then you go to college, and then, you know, all of a sudden you're going to practice. And if you got taken down, like, here's the funny thing. I was good enough that once in a while I could score on my feet, right? Which is almost a detriment in the fact that they'd keep you down. Like, they had to work. You know, if I was on my feet, they might actually have to work. They might actually have to be a little bit guarded. But once they took me down, I mean, I was terrible on bottom for what college wrestling is. And I just remember, you know, just wishing Gable would blow the whistle, wishing they'd start us back on our feet. Just, when in the hell am I going to get off this mat? Like, this is just brutal, you know? But it's also some of the best times of my life, because I was getting better every day. And this wealth of knowledge, you know, I've been around the sport, whatever, let's say 12 years at that point or whatever it is. And all of a sudden, everything was new again. Because there's all this little details that I never had paid attention to before, never had been taught before. And so the sport was brand new. You know, every day I'm going in and I'm learning more and more and more about how to get better. And I'm seeing the improvement daily. So that helped a lot, making it exciting, making it easier. But I tell you what, that first 3 months of darkness, that wasn't the best time of my life. I can promise you that.
So you saying that, does that mean before you got to Iowa, you weren't that wrestling nerd following all the results and knew what was going on with junior nationals and the college scene? Were you just kind of in your own bubble in your own world?
Is that Kyle asking that?
It is.
Yeah. So Andy would readily tell you, you know, I am, you know, we had two TV stations growing up. You know, we lived out in the country, and it was IPTV, and then it was a church station. And so we were outside. We were outside all the time, you know. There was no such thing as message board. Like, I didn't even know about message boards until I got around Jody. I didn't even know there was message boards. I never even knew that stuff existed. And so, like, living a bubble is an understatement. Probably there are some things, like, I can remember just being socially awkward about some things because we didn't have cable. You know, a lot of these kids in town would have, I say city, like Macoka is big, but, you know, in town would have cable and watching shows that I had no clue what the heck they were talking about. No idea. You know, I grew up, you know, coon hunting and deer hunting and wrestling and being outside and fishing. And I actually do my best to try and give my boys that now. You know, like it's definitely going to be a different world. My boys are going to live in a different world than the one I grew up in, but I'm still trying to give them as much as what I think is important in life, you know, still why I can. So.
Thinking back to your style of wrestling, you had an unbelievable ankle pick. It wasn't like Kale Sanderson's. It was more of a cross ankle pick. How'd you develop that skill?
Just, you know, no one can force an ankle pick. And I think that's what people don't understand. You don't force the ankle pick. You force heavy hands. You force being better at hand fighting. Like I'm pretty good at hand fighting, right? Going toe to toe with somebody and being able to beat them up with my hands. And, you get good enough with that and people have to back up. It's back up or be snapped down or get somebody, you know, get a leg attack on yourself or whatever, or get out of the situation and back out of it. And when people would back up, you know, it's either head down to the knee or head in the air. Either way, you got to put pressure on that leg, right? You bring their head down to their leg and that puts pressure on it, or you throw them up so all the weight's on their leg. And it wasn't so much being good at the ankle pick. It was being good at being, you know, heavy with my hands and winning the control ties. And as I got better and better at that, you know, the ankle pick, everybody says that about the ankle pick. And then they watch my highlight tape. The ankle pick's on there about, I don't know, a quarter of the time. I mean, I was very lucky. Like I said, I had great coaches, you know, and I learned control ties really early in college. And when you have a control tie position, that's the hard part, getting to the control tie. Once you have the control tie, it's basically, what is that guy going to give you? You know, is he going to back out and you get an ankle pick? Is he going to try and push forward and you get a snap down? Is he going to try and, you know, float in the middle and you get a double leg? You know, is he going to favor trying to get away from that ankle pick so he gives you a sweet single? You know, all the wrestling was already done getting to the control tie.
When we think of the era, Andy went through some of the wrestlers in that room, but let's maybe talk about your contemporaries, whether it was Jody Strittmatter, Doug Schwab was in the lineup at that time, Mike Zadek. You had some really interesting people around your weight. How did you deal with those guys? Like a Mike Zadek from Montana, you have Doug Schwab from Osage, you have Jody Strittmatter from Pennsylvania. How did you fit in the mix with those lower weight guys?
Yeah, I think I fit in pretty good. I mean, I did fine, you know. You know, Schwab and I never wrestled as much as people think. We definitely wrestled some, probably more in our younger years than we did in our older years. And I don't know why that is. Like, I think he'd tell you the same thing. Jody and I wrestled, you know, here and there, probably, you know, a lot more than I did with Schwab. You know, you just look back. Like, I wrestled that quite a bit. You were always trying to wrestle somebody different. Like, always. You know? And so, if I wrestled Jody, I might not wrestle him again for 2 weeks. You know? If I wrestled Terry, I'm not going to wrestle him again for 2 weeks. Like, you were always varying. But as far as, like, holding my own, I mean, I did pretty, you know, I'm not that guy. Like, I did pretty good. Did just fine.
How about relationally, did you hang out with those guys off the mat?
Yeah. And, you know, again, I was pretty close to Jody just because of the weight cut. You know, we cut a ton of weight. Both had similar goals, both liked to hunt fish. You know, all those guys, Matt Anderson, Jessamyn Smith, you know, Mike Zadek, all those guys, you know, Wes Hand before he left, then Euchre, all, you know, it's like, what year were you in? You know, and obviously my brother, once he got there, you know, you look at wrestling partners that freshman year, you add in, like you're saying, with the contemporaries, but then, you know, Jesse Whitmer, Mike Mena, Mark Ironside, Tom and Terry were still wrestling fairly often. You know, and then as we got through, Jody comes in my junior year, you know, Schwab's already won a national title. Zadek, I think, was already an All-American at that point. Like, you know, just, yeah, that room was brutal. I have a lot of people ask me sometimes, you know, just what it was like, that experience in Iowa. And I tell them that room was insane. People don't understand just how loaded that room was with talent. And I take a lot of pride in the fact that, like, I was part of that talent. You know what I mean? I was part of that viciousness of how tough that room really was.
I've said this often before, and I've had other people articulate the same thing, that I feel like you're the most underrated and underappreciated Hawkeye wrestler to come through the program. And when we compare your statistics, 3-3-1-1, just in the college part, that's better than a lot of other wrestlers, including a Mark Ironside, Doug Schwab, Royce Alger. Your credentials are really amazing. Do you feel underappreciated in the Iowa wrestling program and underrated?
No, and Amy probably knows why. Like, I have always shied away from the limelight. I've always, I'm not that guy. I don't want to be that guy. I have zero interest in being that guy. I don't know. You know, wrestling, it's always weird. I tell people this, and I think they have a hard time fathoming it. The people that know me best know this is true and accurate, but, from an outside perspective, it seems weird. Wrestling was just always something I did. You know, it's not like it was just a pastime. It's not like it was just a hobby. Obviously, wrestling has shaped my life. It's part of who I am now. But there's no doubt growing up, mentality-wise, it was just something we did. Everything I do in life, I try to be good at, you know, and I try to prepare for, and I try to make it as enjoyable and as fun, but yet still try to be as good, I guess, at it as I could. And wrestling was one of those things, like as a sport, it kind of dominated because some of the other sports we couldn't be as good at. You know, football, I'm like 5'7". Never was going to be a good football player. You know, that just wasn't in the car. You know, track, I would run the mile, and the only reason I was even decent, and decent's given me a lot, but the only reason I was even that guy there is because, you know, just mentally tough and would run hard, you know? It's not like I was ultra fast. I would just run as hard as I could for as long as I could, and so I was kind of a, you know, distance runner because of that, and I don't think anybody would ever look at me and say, man, Jurgens is fast. I don't think that's ever come out of anybody's mouth. You know, so sport wise, when it came to sports, wrestling is kind of like our focus, right? From our family, my brother too. Wrestling just kind of became the focus. But like, as far as just overall, you know, I had so many coaches that I still run into every once in a while. And the first thing they'll tell me is, you know, I could never get a hold of you. Like, I would talk to your parents all the time because you were always out coon hunting. Like, that is the comment I get over and over and over, you know, and I don't even have a coon dog anymore. But growing up, like, that was what I thought was fun to do, you know, grab the dog, get home for practice, grab the dog, go out in the woods and try and chase some raccoons, you know. And I know it sounds weird, but, you know, in the summer, spring and fall, it was always fishing. I remember my dad selling my boat, selling our boat. I shouldn't say my boat, selling our boat when I got old enough to drive. I think he was worried I'd, you know, try and take it out all the time by myself, and, you know, probably worried I'd kill myself or something. But yeah, it was just something I did.
And the era that you wrestled was the beginning of the Jim Zaleski era. As we said, you redshirted during Dan Gable's final season as head coach, and then Zaleski took over. You guys won championships in 98, 99, and 2000, then placed second in 2001. Would you just maybe give us an overview of that era and what it was like to be in the wrestling room during the Jim Zaleski era when he had his most success?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I tell everybody, and I'm sure it bothers some people, but the first thing I tell people is they changed the rules that year. There's an asterisk. When you go to NCAA, you know, record books, there's an asterisk at 2001. They changed the rules, and it was to benefit lower placing. Right. So the lower place guys on the podium got more points in a tournament than they did in the past. Under the old rules, we actually won. Under the old rules, if you would have taken the rules of 2000, we would have won as a team, you know, and it would have been a narrow margin. I remember somebody did the math. It wasn't like by much, a couple points, but we would have won. And that one burns me a little bit. It burns me that, you know, we're in Iowa City and you talk about fairy tale, right? It's a fairy tale that I'm in my college town. I'm in the arena that, you know, was the home dual meets and get to win as an individual. And then, you know, all those guys, blood, sweat, tears, that we put into it didn't get to accomplish their goal. And we didn't win as a team. Like that sucked. That was brutal. That was harder than I think people give any of us credit for. That was a tough one to swallow. And as far as like what that room was like, when you talk about the coaches, you know, I think it's pretty well known that those guys didn't get along the best. You know, in the beginning, it was okay. You know, Jimmy and Tom, I would say easily by the time I was getting ready to leave, it was not a good relationship at all, you know, and that's too bad and sad. And I understand, I understand from both sides where the animosity comes from. But that doesn't change the fact that it probably negatively impacted a lot of the guys while they were there, you know.
What stands out to you, though, when you think of the NCAA championships? Because what stands out to me is the number of good guys you wrestled. And I just did a quick list of you wrestled Joe Warren, who was a world champion, Greco, Eric Larkin, Eric Guerrero, Steven Abbas, Johnny Thompson, Cody Sanderson, Teague Moore. You wrestled a ton of good guys. What stands out to you about the competition you faced during your college career?
I mean, I don't know. I don't ever really think about it like that, I guess. I don't know. I just know it was tough. I mean, I think everybody goes through stuff. I remember, was it Dernlin from Purdue? I felt like that guy was the strongest kid I wrestled in all of my college. And Roman Flazar would have been probably the next guy, you know, that guy, Roman Flazar was like moving stone. Guy was strong. You look back and I don't remember, I just remember certain characteristics, I guess, more than anything, of wrestling a guy and them wrestling a certain way, versus anything else, you know. I'm trying to think of the guy I wrestled from Ohio State. I remember wrestling him and always wondering how he didn't get stalled out of the match. You know what I mean? Like, he would stall that bad. I would sit there in my head as I'm wrestling, wondering how this ref doesn't caution him, because he would back out. And the rules were a little different then, you know. It would have been interesting to see how matches would have went if we had the rules we do now. You know, the rules have changed so dramatically, which is kind of hard to believe in folk style, right? There's not a whole lot of flair to it, but, you know, the out of bounds line has changed. The, you know, the stalling on dropping down a leg has changed. You know, some of the riding positions of putting a leg in when they stand up has changed. And I think all great improvements. Probably the one thing I cannot stand is the ref's ability to dictate whether it's a push out or a continuation of action or stalling. I can't stand that rule. I think it's the worst rule in full style wrestling.
I don't know. You said you're naive on wrestling, so I got to make sure you know this. So, do you know who Barry Davis is? He was a 3-time NCAA champ for Iowa.
Yes, I know Barry Davis. Okay. Yes, I know Iowa guys. Okay. I know Iowa guys well.
All right. I'm kind of teasing you here, but I just got to make sure.
Okay.
Have you heard the story about when he wanted Kevin Black to punch you on the mat? Have you heard that story?
What?
Yeah, he wanted him to crack you at the NCAA championships, because I think he felt like you were taking some cheap shots on him. And so Kevin told me this great story. He said, next time you go out there, I want you to just crack him in the mouth.
So did he?
No, he didn't do it.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Like Kevin Black, when I think of him, I think of him as always trying for junk moves, right? Like that guy was. And again, nothing against him. Everybody has their own style. But like, when I think of wrestling him, he would be that guy that would try like a neck wrench, or would try like, you know, goofy moves, right? Like goofy moves, not hardcore, basic solid position wrestling, but like funky. Want to try and pull funk, which funk can be effective when you're not very diligent on stuff. But unfortunately, like, that was how I like to wrestle. Like, good position, stay in good position all the time. Don't get out of good position, you know, because I don't think of myself as athletic in some of those terms. And you let that match go into somebody else's realm, you know, it can get ugly fast.
All right. You got to tell us about wrestling Steven Abbas at the 1998 NCAA championship, because you wrestled him twice. He ended up being a 3-timer Olympic silver medalist, really one of the all-time great college wrestlers, but you beat him twice there. He was already a junior world champion. Were you familiar at all with his credentials and how good he was going into that tournament?
Nope.
Not at all, huh?
They told me he was good. They said be ready. That was about it. Yeah. And I remember those guys, like, very quick. Like, you didn't keep your hands on him, like, absolutely going to disappear on you. right? Like, had to keep your hand on him.
Fast forward to the next round, you wrestle Teague Moore in the semis. And end of the match, what happens there, and how did you deal with that?
You know, as times get older, so back when it first happened, and for probably a couple years after that, I had a resentment for the match, not for Teague Moore. In fact, Teague Moore, like, I respect the hell out of that guy. And here's why. I know nothing about Teague Moore, but I know we went to battle. And when we got up, there's just, I don't know how to describe it. It's like something you grow up your whole life with where, you know, your dad's like, hey, win, lose, or draw, you go out and hug that guy because he put his heart on the mat, you did too, or whatever. And I remember just being dejected. Just, I mean, you know how it is. You put your whole life into something. And it was right there. It was right there. And in a sense, I found a way to lose, right? That's, I'm sure from his side, it's completely different. But, and you know what? He, you know, we shake our hands and he hugs me, and I'm not kidding you. In that split second, it's like you see everything from their side too. Like, he's worked so hard and it was tough, and he knows all your fears. He knows all, like, he shared them, right? Like, everything that I was going through, he was going through too. And there was just that mutual respect of, like, you know, we went to battle and he happened to come out on top. Right. And so I have a huge amount of respect for Teague Moore. And I know that's weird, just that little moment, but that's why. Right. Like, just a ton of respect for that guy. As far as, like, the match, you know, I was winning. And I don't know how many times the coaches told me, don't put your foot on the line unless you're ready. Don't put your foot on the line unless you're ready. And I was always in such a hurry. Like, I like to make the most out of the time. Right. From the second the whistle blows, I was always going to try and improve the position. Like, no one was ever going to accuse me of, like, not trying to wrestle. Let's put it that way. You know what I mean? Like, I was going to try and put points on the board the entire time the match was going. And, I came up to the line and he comes right in. And I mean, at the time I felt like he blew the whistle. Who knows? I mean, I remember looking over at the ref for like a split second, like, surely you're going to blow the whistle, false start. And what bothers me most is I could have kept wrestling. If I'd have just kept wrestling, I don't think he'd have scored, but I didn't keep wrestling. I just kind of, like, couldn't believe he let it go and kind of grabbed his hips, fell to my butt, and he ends up scoring a takedown. And I think he locked up riding time and he ends up winning like 6-4, you know, and it's like, those are the kind of things that I guess haunt you, but not, I mean, like I said, I don't really have regrets. You know, I wish I would have wrestled a better match, but at the same time, maybe that's part of what formed me into today. So,
and then fast forward to your final match, college match, against another Oklahoma State wrestler, Johnny Thompson. Took you to the wire. I think it was 8-7 before he went after you, and then you got the takedown 10-7. But would you walk us through that match and really the excitement of wrestling in Carver Hawkeye Arena for your final college match?
Yeah. You know, if I look back on it, if there's one thing I was good at, it was adjusting during matches. You know, I can point out several matches where guys took advantage of something or I didn't do something right and I changed, right? Johnny Thompson's a great example. You know, I hit a just clean as heck ankle pick on him because he didn't want a hand fight, right? Like, he did not like my hands on him. And that guy was really good at cutting the corner. So, like, I hit that ankle pick, he falls to his butt and scoots behind me and he scores off all my work. Like, you want to talk about dumb. Right? Like, that was just dumb. And I made the adjustment. The next time I hit it, I made sure when he fell to his butt, I stayed back. I made sure he couldn't cut the corner and I got the takedown, you know? Who knows? Who knows? In his head, maybe we wrestle again. He thinks he does better. I felt at the time, had I wrestled him again, I think I would put way more points on the board. You know what I mean? Like, you figure out how guys wrestle and then you make adjustments. And, you know, I only got one opportunity to wrestle them, and you try to make the most of it. And it's under the finals, so you probably aren't as aggressive as normal in a sense. You know, especially being my last collegiate match. But, you know, that's what I remember from that match is feeling stupid in my head. I'm like, I can't believe I let this guy just cut the corner on me. and making sure when I hit the ankle pick again, because he wanted nothing to do with my hands, of making sure he didn't go around, you know? And then when he got in on my leg, like, I just, that was just an adjustment on the way down. Like, yeah, I'm not falling down, you know, like kind of started, he got in on my leg. And I kind of started going like I was going to fall, and I felt him relax. Like he thought I was going down to the mat. And as I started, I just decided, nope, get my leg back, you know? And once he was flat, I guess, you know, I was going to get my leg back.
Tell me about another guy in your team, a little bit heavier than you at 157, TJ Williams, only lost one time as a Hawkeye wrestler. What do you think about him?
You know, I love TJ. Great dude. TJ always wrestled close, right? And everybody on the team knew it. All the coaches knew it. And I'm sure he regrets his day. But that's the way it was. It's like, you know, TJ won how many matches by 1 or 2 points? Like a lot. You know, and he was good enough to do that, right? But the problem with that is there was always that chance of getting scored on. And his junior year, he was that guy where guys would get on his leg. He'd be winning by 1 or 2, and guys would get on his leg, and he'd be on his butt. He'd be on his butt wrapped over top of him. And most of the time, the ref didn't give the takedown. But everybody sat there and was like, dude, you are playing with fire. At least I did. In my head, it was like, you are playing with fire. Like, I would never take that chance. Like, I'm not that guy, right? I like to put all the odds on my side or as much as possible. And I just remember thinking all the time, like, man, you're going to get burned one of these times. And, of course, where does it happen? You know, it happens in the national tournament. And guy's in on his legs and falls to his butt like he'd done probably 5 or 6 times that year. If you were to go back through his footage. Except this time the ref calls 2 and the time runs out and he loses, you know? And to me, it was a travesty almost, because he should have been a 3-time national champ. You know, that guy was that talented and that good and tough wrestler, super tough wrestler.
That tournament you're talking about, you know, 2000, that Friday in St. Louis, a really dark day for Iowa wrestling. You guys go in with such firepower and Jody gets knocked off, Schwab gets knocked off, Zadik gets beat, TJ suffers his only loss as a Hawkeye. It comes down to you and Wes Hand making the finals. But Friday night, it looks like Iowa State's got this thing in the bag, at least. You know, I remember reading a headline in another newspaper in Iowa, basically saying it's pretty much a formality for Iowa State at this point. What do you remember about leaving the arena that night and getting ready to wrestle on Saturday, and what did it look like from a point standpoint in your heads at that point?
You know, adjustment wise, that was a tough one to watch with Jody. You know, I was, you know, Jody was my main drill partner. Jody's one of my best friends to this day. And that was the year that our relationship even started, right? Like, we were working out all the time, we were drilling all the time, and to see him lose, you know, he took the guy down and he threw in the legs and the kid, boom, he's just one of those kids. You couldn't throw legs in, you know, and he gets reversal and gets on top again. In my opinion, clearly the better wrestler, and it gets reversal again. And one of those things where the way, you know, he gets reversal and then the time's running out, you know, boom, second period, except he's not winning, you know, because the guy, you know, he got the takedown, but then the guy gets the reverse. And then, you know, it was just a tough one to see him lose that match, knowing or feeling that he was the better wrestler, and seeing some of those other guys that you thought, I guess there's no such thing as a shoe-in, right? There's no shoe-in at the NCAA tournament, but it felt like there was as close to shoe-ins as possible, right? Like TJ getting taken down and losing. And granted, we all thought throughout the season it could happen, but you still don't expect it to happen. Right? Like he didn't get taken down any of those other times. Why would it happen now? And he did. And so it was just, like you said, dark. That's a good word for it. It just felt real dark. It felt real hard to stay upbeat, whatever. And that's when you're trying to get into that mental thing of just, you can't worry about those other guys, right? Like you want to, you feel for them. You want to be sad with them, and you want to, you know, you want to forget about it as soon as possible and move on with life. But at the same time, you just got to focus on you, you know? And I think that's basically what we try to do, is I try to stay in my own head and tried to stay upbeat and try not to focus on the team race too much. And, you know, and then obviously that morning we had a stellar morning and we were back in it, you know, and I don't know. It was definitely something to relive those. You know, we don't talk, it's not like I talk about this stuff much.
What do you talk about when it comes to wrestling? What's your involvement right now? Of course, you have a club that we talked about, but do you follow the sport much? And what's your involvement with Iowa wrestling at this point?
Yeah, no, I don't. I got a bunch of stuff. You know, for one, I have a five-year-old and a seven-year-old. My seven-year-old actually turns eight this month. And those guys are just starting to get into wrestling, right? They're just starting to. And I don't know. Maybe they might never compete. Ever. I don't know. You know what I mean? And I don't mean these little kids tournaments. I mean, who knows? They might get to high school and never want to be in wrestling. I know I don't want to be that dad. It is their path. It is their choice. It is what they want to do in life. Are they going to, like, am I going to be that parent that makes them try as hard as they can at what they do? Absolutely. Absolutely. But like for now, I mean, they're going to wrestle because it makes them better people. But obviously that's a big time commitment with the kids, whether it's in practices or you know, taking them outside. They started hunting a little bit in the last year or two, like squirrel hunting and stuff. And they sit in the deer stand with me a little bit and they've got their little four wheelers. They ride around and actually got them a little snowmobile this year. It's kind of cute. But, yeah, I mean, I stay involved with them. I obviously have my full-time job, you know, the practices with the young guns and you know, every Tuesday, Thursday. So time is not like everybody. Time is just not your friend, right? You only have so much time. I try to keep tabs. Obviously, I follow the headlines. You know, I'll follow the matches if I get a chance. I try to get to a meet every year. And that's unfortunately about my main goal is I try to get one meet a year and just try to stay in contact a little bit and follow them and support them. And, yeah.
So you've heard of Spencer Lee at least, right?
Oh, come on. You guys are being ridiculous.
Well, of course we are. Obviously, that's the whole point. We're having fun.
Guys, yeah, I was going to say, like, obviously, I'm, you know, Spencer's the youngest kid on top of everything. So, obviously, I'm going to know Spencer. But, yeah, I mean, I follow the Hawkeyes. I certainly don't follow much for wrestling outside of Hawkeyes. You know, that's for sure.
What's your earliest memory, Spencer?
Oh, I mean, tough. World champion. I remember Jody talking about him and it's weird how he knew that, he saw the talent that early. And, you know, he's telling me about this new kid in club and how his parents met. They met on a judo team, like an Olympic judo team. And I, you know, I couldn't tell you if the dad was competing or if the mom was competing or if both were coaches or one was coach. I couldn't tell you exactly, but I know they're both involved in some kind of Olympic judo stuff. And, he was telling me about how tough Spencer was. And he's sitting there, he's like, you know, you just don't know. This kid could be like the next world champ. You know, he's got that kind of athletic ability. And sure enough, as he's, you know, I get to see him around camps and everything. It's like, this kid's definitely different. You know what I mean? He is tough. He is so strong for that weight level. Just crazy strong for that weight level. And it shows. It shows when he gets on top of people and starts going to town. And that's not to say he's not a technical wrestler. He is. But man, oh man, does he take over on top. You know, he gets that wrist. And most guys are used to being able to peel that wrist off. And it doesn't happen with him.
Here's my final question, and then Andy can add any additional questions that he wants. But when you are in college, there's a young budding journalist named Andy Hamilton walking into the wrestling room. What did you think?
You know, I have all sorts of stories about Andy, and I guarantee you Andy has way too many about me. There's a late night wrestling story at Andy's apartment or duplex or whatever at the time. But, you know, it's one of those things. It's kind of nice, you know. I became friends with Andy back in the day. And I still, you know, we still every once in a while get to reach out and see how each other is doing. And that's the beauty of friendships, right? Like, it's not like any time's really passed. You check in and see how life is going. And Andy's still Andy, and I hope I'm still Eric, you know.
You want to share that story about the late night wrestling?
No. I don't think it's for the podcast.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm disappointed. I thought, man, maybe this might be the day you share that story. So maybe off the podcast you'll share it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, hey, thanks for joining us. This was a lot of fun being able to learn about your career. It sounds like you definitely are an outlier, and that's why you are successful, and that's why you are one of the all-time greats in Iowa wrestling history. All the best as you move forward, and thanks for spending this time with us, Eric.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on, and hopefully it's what you're kind of looking for.
Absolutely what we were looking for. We're going to look into the 2001 Iowa versus Minnesota and how the points went. I always thought that Minnesota still would have won by something like a point or two, but you may be right.
You want to take the bet?
I don't. I do not, because I don't know, because I only heard it from one side that they still would have won. So I'm really fascinated by that piece of it that you guys may have won with the new point system, because I do vividly remember that. I remember they bumped it up by 2 points for each place other than second and first. So 8th place was 1 point. Yeah, they bumped it up to 3.
Yeah, and what I really would like to know is why. You know, that's what, and I get it, right? Like, at some point, everything changes. Like, there doesn't necessarily have to be a reason between that year and another year. But it was just really curious to me why that year, when Minnesota obviously had some firepower up and down the lineup, right? Like, you know what I mean? Maybe not all sorts of stars, but definitely tough kids up and down the lineup. Why that year? You know, it's kind of weird to me. But like, I, you know, here's, you want one more good little tidbit story?
I do.
You guys want another? Okay. So, you know, Jody and I were friends with those guys. You know, we were friends. And I don't know if this is for everybody or not. Like, I felt like in our era, the top wrestlers kind of got it, right? Like the fans, to me, sometimes can ruin sports, right? They don't understand everybody works hard. Only their guy should win, et cetera, et cetera, if that makes sense, right? Whereas the athletes, they get it. They get everybody else to bust their butt. They get everybody else has the hopes, fears, dreams, all that stuff. And so we're friends with a lot of those tough wrestlers on other teams, Minnesota being one of them. And, you know, we ended up not winning that year. And we went to our Hawk party, and it's not a put down on the Hawk party at all. The fans had expectations and we didn't meet them. But it was almost like a tomb, right? You know, instead of being like, hey, you know, you guys poured your hearts out. We didn't quite make it. We still took second in the country. You know what I mean? Like, it's a heck of an accomplishment any year. But it really wasn't kind of that mentality, which I get. I get as a competitor, I get that. But also as a competitor, you also know, like, at the end of the day, it's what's done is done. Move forward, next goal, right? And so Jody and I, we went to the Minnesota party. That's not a joke. We went to the Minnesota party and hung out with the Minnesota guys and their fans because, you know what? They were happy and they were celebrating. And it's not like we went the whole night. We were at the Hawk party for a little bit. But after a while, we're like, you know what? Like, this is pointless. Like, you know, like, there's no reason not to be excited and happy. Like, you know, the season is over. We put our hearts into it, and like, let's go be excited about things. And so we did. Went to the Minnesota party and party with those guys, you know, Lawrence and Vega and you know, all those guys, Kraft. Like, it was, you know, hard time. It was a good time. You know, all, like, some of the Minnesota guys that were back. You know, so it was good.
I think that we had Leroy Vega on the program maybe 2 or 3 shows ago, and he's selling fireworks. I think there's an opportunity with you two. You're selling guns. He has fireworks. I think you guys could do something together.
Yeah. Hey, I'm always up for throwing darts. What? We can talk business ideas some other time. Absolutely.
Maybe you can borrow Freedom Frank. He's got this, like, I don't know, what is this, 18, 20-foot? Inflatable eagle.
Yeah.
That he has out front of his business.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Are you kidding me?
No.
I guess I don't know anything about this. So he sells fireworks.
He sells fireworks. Yeah. He sells fireworks in Indiana. And he's this entrepreneur guy. I mean, he's something else, man. I really like this dude. He's a great guy.
Oh, he's a great dude. Great guy. But isn't he a coach? Is he not a coach?
Yeah, he's on the staff at Purdue.
Yeah, I was like, what am I missing? So he does both.
Yeah, he does both.
Got several things going on. Yeah.
he commutes in.
Good for him.
Yeah, he's quite a guy.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I get it. I mean, I sell some firewood on the side. I've got a Bernese Mountain Dog. They just got bred to have Bernese mini Bernedoodles, you know. So always trying to enlarge the portfolio. Absolutely.
Well, sounds like a great opportunity. Thanks for this opportunity. We really enjoyed having you on the mat, and we can't wait to see you at an Iowa meet very soon.
All right. Well, hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
When it comes to wrestling singlets, trust me, as a former wrestler myself, there is nothing else out there like Cliff Keen uniforms. There's a reason they've been around since the 1950s. With wrestling season now lasting throughout the year, Cliff Keen is running a promo for our loyal On The Mat subscribers. Go to CliffKeen.com, build and order a set of Cliff Keen custom singlets, and type in the coupon code On The Mat and receive 20% off your order. Coupon code On The Mat gets you 20% off singlets. This is a limited time deal, so take advantage of it while you can. It's that easy.
That was Eric Juergens, former Iowa wrestling star, and I didn't know what to expect. I think you did, because you've known Eric for, what, 2 decades now? Maybe a little bit over than that?
Yeah, I think about probably 22-ish years now.
Yeah, so really enjoyed his insight. And what I like the most, probably the thing that stood out, was the UNI recruiting story.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I had no idea that Kilgard, I had to assume that Kilgard would have thought about Northern Iowa since two of his brothers went there, but I didn't know how close they were to getting both those guys. And when you look back at it, that could have been the game changer for Don Briggs, because he was let go shortly thereafter. So who knows, if you get Juergens and Kilgard into the program, that may have changed the trajectory of his career and his life. I think it worked out great for Briggs, because he's done so many things with adventure pursuits and different things. But boy, those moments change a lot. And that story really stands out to me.
And think about how it could have possibly changed things for Iowa. You never know who would have been filling. At the time, Eric was, you know, his first couple of years, 118 pounds, and moves up to 133. And won him a national title in 2000. I mean, that Eric doesn't win that match against Cody Sanderson. There's one fewer trophy in the Iowa case and one more national championship at Iowa State.
But it goes back to one of the talking points we've had on this show, and I ranted about it, is that when these coaches or these people that come on and say, I could coach a team with that much talent, all right, go ahead and get them. I mean, you're saying, yeah, if you have Eric Juergens and Doug Schwab and all these guys, yeah, I could coach that team. But here's an example of how close it was that you didn't get that talent in your program. So I say hogwash to those people. Again, we could go on another rant, or at least I could, but wait till you have to try to get that talent and then cultivate it. Different story. But the story of Eric Juergens was fascinating. Really enjoyed learning about his life and career, especially, I just didn't know he was that naive to it all. I just had no idea. I mean, because you get a picture of someone on the mat and you're watching a guy, you see him win championships, have never really interacted with him, have only seen him once, maybe talked publicly. And that was when Iowa came back and introduced him, and he talked on the mic in front of 15,000 fans. But other than that, I really haven't known about his past and his story. So really fun for me anyway to dive into what made him tick.
So much stuff we didn't even get into. I mean, we could have gone on another hour at least. I mean, we didn't talk about his stint as a college head coach. We didn't talk about his career in MMA. You know, we a lot of ground we still could have covered.
Yeah, there is a lot there. And I think that's maybe another opportunity down the road that we could get him back on. But I enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to this edition of On the Mat. For Andy Hamilton, I am Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.